Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I'm your host, Deanna Chapman, and I'm joined today by Katie Schaefer to discuss the 1989 Pet Sematary, directed by Mary Lambert. This is the first of multiple adaptations to come of this story, and you know, it shows its age at times, but otherwise, pretty solid adaptation. Wouldn't you agree, Katie?
I agree with all of what you said. It shows its age, but I remember watching this when I was really young, and it was terrifying when it was much, you know, when at the time it would have been a much more, you know, visually it would have looked more stunning, mm-hmm. whereas now we, you know, we've seen a lot more, but yeah, I liked it. I enjoyed watching it again.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where you get some big names in this movie. So, you know, just looking back on it, you're like, oh, wow, they really went for it with the names. And as far as the main three go, which would be Dale Midkiff, Fred Gwynne, and Denise Crosby as your three adult characters. And then you have Gage and Ellie, which Gage was played by Miko Hughes. And Ellie was actually played by twins. So you have Blaze Burdahl and her twin sister, whose name I am totally blanking on right now, but it was basically because of the way the child labor laws are. So it's easier to have twins because you can have one on set, and then when they have to be taken off set, you could just put the twin in. And
right.
I found that very interesting because it's like, you know what? That's really smart. And how often do we see twins playing the same role as children?
Yeah, I don't know how often it is.
It happens more often than you think.
I would guess, but I didn't think it usually happened at that age. I thought usually as babies, but I was surprised that they were still doing it with her because she's got to be like 7, 6, something like that.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I think, you know, Full House is kind of the prime example of that with the Olsen twins playing the same character. And, you know, I don't know if they're by far the most famous twins to have done that, but they're the ones that immediately come to mind for me, at least.
Same. I'm sure there's others, but for kids our age, or for people, we're not kids, thankfully, for people our age, it's always the Olsen twins.
Yeah, absolutely. And just the fact that they were able to get Fred Gwynne in this too, it's like, okay, you know, here's this guy who is massive in comparison to everyone else, and yet he was still able to really just make you think he was the one and only Judd Crandall.
Yes, I totally agree. Like, Fred Gwynne was such already an iconic figure at this time. You know, he's Herman Munster, and he is able to take all of his talent and really work it into this small character that has such a big impact on the story.
Yeah.
You know, he has the perfect, like, main backcountry, you know, simple man who's grown up and stayed in the same place his whole life. And it works so well. And I think that is a big part of why the movie succeeds as much as it does.
Yeah. And just a quick note, Bo Burdahl is the name of the other sister. I was totally blanking on that. I was like, I know they both start with B and it's something like that, but I didn't want to say anything without being totally sure. And I really think they just nailed the casting for this, even having Zelda be played by, you know, sort of like this scrawny male, and just putting all of this stuff on him to make Zelda look as creepy as possible, who is Rachel's sister, in case anyone is listening to this and hasn't watched it. But you should probably stop the podcast now and go watch it, because we're definitely going to spoil everything, because this movie is 30 years old.
So, yeah, something like that.
You've had time. What did you find most interesting about how well this cast worked together?
It feels like such like a late 80s cast.
Yeah.
You know, with the people in it had their biggest moments, excepting Fred Gwynne. The two, the married couple in it, have their biggest moments at this time. This was when Denise Crosby was on Star Trek. So, and that's what she is, of course, the most well known for generally. And I watched Star Trek religiously as a kid. So watching it both when I was young and now, it was all I could think of is this is Tasha Yar. But she does a decent job. I think Denise Crosby's skills as an actress really lie in something that's more dramatic and less naturalistic. So she does a decent job in this, but I don't know that she is the most perfect choice for the role, if you'll take that.
Mm-hmm.
But he does a good job. Like, I really enjoyed him as an actor. Like, he's Dale Midkiff is the right amount of upset and engrossed in the whole idea of it, of the Pet Sematary and all of bringing people back from the dead. But you still believe him as a doctor, and his emotional responses feel very accurate to the situation he's in. So for the most part, the acting in this is great. And that baby, Miko Hughes, is so perfect for the role. He's very adorable, but very creepy.
Yeah, and that's another thing where, you know, the child labor laws came into play, because they actually used, like, these practical dummies of him for certain scenes. You know, they weren't going to drop a child out of a ceiling or, you
right.
know, have a child, you know, fake stabbing Judd Crandall. So they took all of these different precautions to not traumatize him because he was so young.
Yeah.
And they did have one incident, I believe, on set where they were just like, oh boy, we just traumatized this child. And it's one of those things where you have to find that fine line to balance a child's role, especially in a story like Pet Sematary, because if you read the book, and obviously he had not read the book by any means at that age, or had it read to him, I should say, because he probably wasn't reading to begin with. So you have this story that someone his age at the time couldn't really understand. And you just have to sort of really work with him to get sort of these things for the performance out of him. And they did a lot of different practical tricks. Like, they didn't actually have him in the road when the truck was coming down the road, even though obviously in the final product, it looks like that. So they had like mirrors and all these sorts of things. And it was just really interesting how they handled, especially the children on the set, because of the nature of the story. And like you said, Denise Crosby, she does a fine job with the performance. And obviously, they really liked her in auditions. And that's why she got the role. That's why, you know, most people get the role. And it's funny, she just showed up in a show I watch in Suits. And I was looking and I was like, she was in a Stephen King thing, wasn't she? Because I was totally blanking on what it was. And then I went and watched the documentary Unearthed and Untold, The Path to Pet Sematary, which is, you know, where we found out a lot of this information about how the movie was made. And I highly, highly suggest watching that. It's about an hour and a half. So it's, I guess, kind of long, given that the movie was probably only about the same length. So it has a lot of interesting tidbits in it, though. And it's definitely worth your time, especially if you are a huge fan of Pet Sematary. And just finding out all of those things was a fun little way to be like, oh, okay, so we really understand how this cast came together. And then you have things happening like random famous people just visiting the set, in addition to all of the non-famous people who apparently could just go visit the set because it was 1989 and they didn't have like 8,000 rules like they do now. So you have Charlie Sheen and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar just showing up and hanging out. So there's that.
Right? It seems like it was such a bizarre set to work on, probably because they filmed a lot of it in Maine, and which is not, especially then, it's not easy. Filming versus filming in Hollywood, you're dealing with small towns, you have to work with the local people. And yeah, I imagine this set would have been just a very chaotic place.
Yeah.
And even more than that, like, they say that if as an actor, you never want to work with kids or animals. And they had both in this film, and they did some really amazing work with the cats who play Church.
Yeah.
And all of those performances out of that cat, I was like, I just wonder how they're even getting this cat to be so angry. I hope it's not actually angry. And that makes the tricks that they pull to make this movie come off look even better. So even with all of the visitors to the set and the local people who they interview in that documentary, who obviously were like, ooh, I'm going to stand across the street and stare at them while they're filming type thing, like they still managed to pull off quite a lot. And I think we kind of have to give all that to Mary Lambert, who was able to make this chaotic thing come into one very well done adaptation.
Oh, absolutely. And you could tell that she definitely had a vision for what she wanted this story to look like on the screen. And with the screenplay being by Stephen King, it was one of those things where, you know, sometimes those things work out well, sometimes they don't. We saw with Maximum Overdrive that when he wanted to direct something, maybe not so good. So,
yeah, maybe not.
He is someone who is willing to let other people take on his work, and he doesn't need to be as hands-on with it. But then sometimes he just really likes a story so much. And this one was one that was intensely personal to him, because a lot of the events that happen in the story happened in his life. They just had different outcomes. You know, obviously no one was coming back from the dead. So, you know,
none of his children died.
Right. I mean, they had a scare and one did run out into the street in front of a truck, but the child is fine. So,
right. I believe that was Joe Hill.
Yeah.
Who now writes books.
Okay. I figured it was either Joe or Owen because they said it was one of the boys, and either way, they both write books. So it's like, okay, yes. Right. Great. Thank you for that.
Yes. Yes. It is his most personal. This character feels very much like the persona that King presents himself to be as a writer, which I'm sure is, you know, we all have a work face, and writers more so than others, I think, usually. And he really sketches out Lewis as a very down-to-earth, thoughtful guy who isn't really believing a lot of what happens until it happens and forces him into it, you know? And I liked that, because yeah, especially when you learn that the initial idea for the story came from his own experiences, it fits in so well. And it feels very like a very lived in story, although it is a very basic and simple story. And like, this is what happens. And it doesn't go into a lot of his other books, like let's say It, where there's so much going on.
Everything.
The story is, yeah, everything, the story is so big and encompasses the whole town. Whereas this, for King especially, is a very small story about one family and a neighbor.
Yeah, even Lewis's work at the school is secondary. Obviously, it gives you the whole storyline with Victor Pascal and him sort of coming back to haunt Lewis. And he has this rough first day at work. So there's just so much grief in this story. And when you typically talk about how well a movie is adapted from a book, when you have the author writing the screenplay, obviously he's going to want to keep a lot of what he loves from the story. And the only thing I've ever really wanted out of a Pet Sematary adaptation is that exact ending that they have in the book, which we don't get either time. So there is that. And they did reshoot the ending, I believe, 2 or 3 times for this one. So they did have some alternate endings planned out. But from what I can tell, there is one that comes close to the ending in the book where, you know, Rachel puts her hand on Lewis and just says, darling, and the book ends. And you're like, yes, that's so good, because we don't need more than that.
Right. We don't know what's going to happen. That is the truly powerful thing about it. We don't know what's going to happen with her or what she's going to do or how it's going to all come out. We sense it'll be bad, but we don't know. And I think the Pet Sematary does an okay job with the ending.
Yeah.
Because I think in a novel that kind of subtlety and abruptness to an end can work better than in a movie, because movie fans often, they want more closure.
Right.
So, but I still think it might have been more powerful and more affecting.
And honestly, that's really my one complaint about the adaptation of this, because it does everything else pretty well. You know, like we talked about, most of the performances are pretty dang good. And you have the story, which is pretty in line with what the book gives us. And, you know, to me, the book is like a 5 out of 5. You know, it was just a fantastic story, and yes, it was well paced and everything. So to have this movie come out a few years later and have all of these expectations built up, I would imagine, you know, obviously I had seen the movie, I believe, before reading the book, because I watched this, then I went to watch the new one, and I was like, okay, I'm pretty familiar with the story. And even if I hadn't watched this original in full before recently, I still knew kind of what to expect, because I think it was one of those movies that, you know, you kind of catch glimpses of on TV, especially like around Halloween time. You know, they're always playing the Stephen King movies on TV, and
yeah,
Halloween, Friday the 13th, all those movies. So I've definitely caught glimpses of this, but I had never really sat down to watch it all the way through. And I was surprised with how well it stood up, too.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I watched it, like I said, I watched it at a sleepover at a friend's house when I was probably, I don't know, 11, maybe. And at the time, and up until I watched it again, I watched it a couple months ago, and then I rewatched it last night. At the time, before the rewatches, I still was like, oh no, that movie is too upsetting. I can't handle that, because of how much it freaked me out as a kid. Like, I was anxious going into the rewatch. And then after I rewatched, I was like, oh, okay, no, this is not the, you know, terrifying thing I thought it was at that age, for me now, at least. And then, so I was kind of a little disappointed. And then I rewatched it again last night. I was like, oh, okay, I can see how this is a really good movie, because I was able to let go of all the previous experiences and look at it as a different film. And I was surprised at how good I thought it was, because it is very 80s, those shoulder pads and all of Denise Crosby's outfits.
Yeah.
They are very large. It still works so well. And the Victor Pascal scenes, well, it is totally an 80s film with the special effects, still work. It's still creepy, especially the makeup and the, what are they, the piece on his head with how it's all messed up.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
that still,
yeah,
looks very realistic.
His giant
the creature
wound.
Effects. Yes, the creature effects. And it really made me feel good that the movie was actually better than I remember from watching it even just a couple months ago, because it was like, this is one of the stories that I totally agree is one of King's best and deserves a really great adaptation.
The reason it stands up so well too is, despite it being set in the 80s with, you know, the giant shoulder pads, like you said, and all of those things that come with the 80s, right, it's a story that is still one you can relate to today. Not necessarily, you know, the animals and the kid coming back to life, but as far as the grief goes and parents losing a child, you can understand why they're feeling all of the things that they're feeling. And it's not a story that is so rooted in the time period that it wouldn't age as well.
Right. I agree. It's kind of a timeless one that works no matter what era it is, especially in the scenes where Judd tells the story of the young man who died and whose dad brings him back to life. What is his name? Tommy?
Right.
Something like that.
Yeah.
And Timmy, I think. And he goes into this great detail, and that happens in the book as well. And the book takes place a little earlier than the movie does, because the movie sets it in the what was the present day. And so that kid is a veteran of World War II, and it is horrific in the book. And I thought they do such a great job at channeling that in the movie, but they don't make him a World War II vet, and they just kind of, he's at some war and comes home, and it still works. It's still upsetting and it's still creepy. And the story is easy to adapt to whatever time period you want.
Yeah, I actually forgot about one other thing that I noticed that was pretty absent in both adaptations. But in this one, it surprised me that they didn't have Judd's wife Norma in it at all, because she is alive in the book for at least part of it, if I'm not mistaken. And you get to know this character a little bit, and you have Ellie going over and asking questions and all of this curiosity in the book that I guess maybe just for the sake of time, they didn't want to throw in that other another B plot, basically.
Right. And it's always the old ladies that get cut out of these kinds of stories. I've noticed.
Yeah.
I watched the new one and I saw that's what they did. I was like, of course, we don't get Norma in this, because I love that character in the book. And I think in the book, he uses that to really develop the background and meaning behind the story, which is about learning about death as a young child and learning how you have to cope with it, and then how you can very negatively cope with it by literally holding on to the bodies of people that you loved who are gone, and the healthy and not healthy ways to deal with that. And Norma is the person who, you know, in the book, she dies and Ellie has to learn to deal with that grief, because there's no bringing Norma back. She's far too old. And so right. It really underlines the deeper emotions in the story. And so to a certain extent, the film feels like it's lacking that emotional depth. It feels much more like just a horror story than the deeper levels of engagement that the book gives you.
Having Norma in the book, too, also gives you this added element to Judd's character. In the movie, he's all alone, so he really clings on to the Creed family and kind of looks at them as his surrogate children and grandchildren, in a sense. But when you have Norma present in the book, you know, you get why Judd is the way he is and why he's not even going to bother trying to bring Norma back. It's like he understands the power of the Mi'kmaq burial grounds and how they can draw you to them. But because of how long he's seen these things happening, he's sort of just like, yeah, no, there's no point. But with Lewis, he gets so attached that he's like, I have to do this. I have to save them all.
Yes. And I think this adaptation doesn't really go into the background stories behind it, like the Wendigo that Stephen King puts in the book, or mm-hmm. the more supernatural aspects of the Mi'kmaq burial ground and the reasoning behind the supernatural aspects. And so it does feel a little like, Judd, why'd you tell them about this? You knew it was a bad sitch. You knew it was bad. Why would you do this? And they give it a couple throwaway lines of like, oh, that place gets into you. And it's like, but there's, that never feels as important as it is in the book, and why that makes everything so much more evil and dark. So it was like, I did notice that this time around that felt a little short, because you're just kind of asked to just accept it. It's fine. Go on. Enjoy other things.
Yeah, definitely. I want to talk a little bit about some of the other things that I'm just now remembering that they cut out. Because in the book, you see a good amount of Lewis's work life, but they cut a bunch of that out in the movie. You know, he has this work friend who comes by a lot after Gage's death, and you don't quite get that as in depth either. And again, I understand why they had to cut some things out. Even if Pet Sematary isn't Stephen King's longest book, it's still a pretty hefty book as far as how dense it is with information.
Right. It's cram-packed with story, which you can't say of all of his books, but this one is, it deserves the space that he gives it, I think.
Yeah, and you and I recently talked about The Tommyknockers, and that was a longer book that felt like it had less story in it. So I definitely understand what you mean by, you know, this one was packed and not all of his stories are necessarily that way. But with this one, it felt like there was an importance to everything he was telling us in the novel. And then when you get to the movie, it's like, okay, they are definitely going mostly for practical effects here. So a lot of the supernatural elements and things that we read about in the book, maybe those just weren't going to look as good in 1989 on the screen. And we'll talk about visuals in a bit here, but story-wise, there's always so much more in a book that you can't cram into a movie. Even if you look at, you know, like Harry Potter, they had 7 books, 8 movies, and there's still so much that they couldn't even pack into those movies because the books get longer and longer pretty much as you go. And J.K. Rowling just has sort of this detailed purpose for a lot of what she puts in the books, even as they do get longer. You're like, oh, wow, I forgot about all these things. And the same can be said of this story for Stephen King. It's like, he put all of these details in because he thought they were important to understand what it is about this place. that really just draws people to it and keeps them coming back. And we don't quite get that in the movie, but we get, like you said, those few throwaway lines. And I think Dale Midkiff sells the performance enough to where you're like, okay, he is really consumed by this.
Yeah, I think that is kind of the saving grace of that they, you know, I'm sure it was cut for time and it just couldn't be included. And he is entirely reliant to be the one to bring that to the screen. And you're right. His face, his eyes, like everything about him is strained and tense as soon as, you know, as soon as Gage dies. He is on a mission and he is going to do this. And then, you know, he finds the Gage maybe doesn't work so well. And then he's immediately back into it with Rachel. And it feels like you can almost sense it in him as the viewer. You can see that he's under some kind of spell.
Yeah, he sort of gives the most, I guess you could say, visceral performance just because of all of the physical emotion you see coming out of him. You know, he is going to the cemetery. He is digging up Gage's grave to get him out of there. He is carrying his wife. And, you know, he's doing all of this literal heavy lifting, too, you know.
Right.
Because it's not like they could CGI these, you know, bodies onto his arms and he's not actually really holding much at all. Instead, you know, I think this is a good time to just talk about some of the interesting things they did visually with this movie, because he's not carrying Denise Crosby when he's carrying Rachel. He is carrying a dummy of her, basically. And she's wrapped in a blanket, so that's kind of irrelevant whether or not it's a real person under there or not. And they created these molds of the characters that look so lifelike. They even did the same with Judd when Gage stabs him and, you know, his mouth is all...
Oh.
His mouth is all destroyed and, like, disgusting.
Yes.
And you have these different sort of puppets of Gage because they're like, okay, we are not going to traumatize this child and make him, you know, pretend to stab Judd in the face. You know, right. We're just not going to right. do that. And
yeah, let's not.
Some of it looks so real, and that's why it stands up pretty well too, because they didn't try to do anything as far as like technically trying to use the computers to make this stuff look better. Instead, they're like, we're going practical. They even created an entire facade for Judd's house because the house across the street was much smaller than what King describes in the book. And it was a different style of house too. So you really need to nail that down. And they literally like burn it down. And it's this facade in front of an actual house. So you have to burn it down without burning the other house down. And you just have all of these things that you don't really know about until, like you and I did, we went and watched that documentary I mentioned, which, by the way, is on Amazon Prime. So I will link to it. And again, I highly recommend checking that out because that's where we got a lot of this information. And it is very, very interesting to find out how people do things, because they specifically mentioned that Gage had no stunt person. You know, he can't, because the stunt person would have to be a right. child. Like, that right. makes no sense.
We had to get a 3-year-old stunt person in here. Yeah. That's, I don't think so. And the dummies are done very well.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that you can't tell.
Right.
Because, like, the scene where part of that is definitely, you know, it's a dummy because no one is going to drop a 3-year-old out of a ceiling.
Or burn him.
It's just not going to happen, you know? So part of that is it's just kind of impossible to suspend your disbelief, so you're more likely to notice. But in the other scenes where they used a dummy, like, it's not always able to tell because it's more that, like you said, they don't want to traumatize this kid. So they'll just show his face, you know, he'll be making it an angry face, and then he's stabbing Judd, and it's a dummy doing the stabbing.
Yeah,
but they'll still get a lot of facial reaction shots from him,
so that action right is happening off screen technically.
Right And like, so it's like when they show, you know, they have someone dancing really well, but that actor can't dance for crap, so it works generally. And I think the practical effects are really impressive for the time. And I mean, even for now, since practical effects are kind of not used as much as they should be, I would say.
Yeah.
So learning about all that really made me impressed with how well they were able to pull this off, especially the building the house thing around the other house. That was, and they had footage of it and you could see the differences and it was really nifty.
Yeah, they did a lot of work to make sure that this looked as realistic as a supernatural Stephen King story can look.
Right.
One of the other things is just the makeup that they did. You know, all of the foam that they put on the actor who played Zelda to make that spine look as disconfigured as it did, and just to make him look so sickly. And then you have Victor Pascal's head wound, and you have Denise Crosby coming back from the dead as Rachel, and just the way her face looks. And, you know, you have all of these big makeup effects too that just look so good for the time. And I would say the only visual that stood out to me as something that didn't age super well was when they kind of like superimposed Victor as a ghost, sort of. And you're like, I don't think this is working as well as he wanted it to, but it's 1989, so we're gonna let it go. And I don't even know if superimposed is like the correct term. I'm not like super up to date on my film terminology, so it's kind of like, that's what it looked like to me, basically.
Yeah, it's not as bad as like the Star Wars, like the little projections they have of people that move around.
Right, the holograms.
Yeah, but it's not too great either. It's kind of how I felt about it. It looks like someone has a light projector, and that's how they're, just probably how they made it happen with mirrors and stuff. But you do think at the time, it's like, oh, well, you did all right. At least you didn't just kind of...
They tried.
put a real person in there, you know, and then use some weird, very simplistic effects to make him look ghostly. So it was, that was one of those like, okay, guys, I'm just going to give you a pass on this. But the other thing I wanted to touch on with the special effects is all of those outdoor scenes mm-hmm. where the path through to the Mi'kmaq burial ground are very creepy. Yeah. And climbing up those giant stone blocks over a quarry and all of that, just they make that look just incredibly dangerous and scary. And like, you look at it and you think, oh, I'm not going to be doing that. No, thank you. And yet they're lugging dead bodies through it. And there's ancient old Fred Gwynn, who had to be in like his 70s, just climbing up these giant stairs. And he really did that.
Yeah.
So you got to give it to the man for still being spry at that age to climb up stairs that come up about to his waist. So, and he's very big dude. So that says something if it comes up that high.
Especially just climbing up that section where it's like all, you know, the tree branches and the sort of driftwood, deadwood, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. And I was really impressed when I was like, oh, that was actually all real. And they actually did all of that work themselves. And it shows in the movie, too, because they actually look tired.
Yeah, I bet it was, I hope they only had to do one or two takes of that.
Hopefully.
And the lighting. The other thing that's really well done is the lighting in this. It's bright when it needs to be at points where, like, you can clearly see what's going on with Gage, even at night. But when they're going through the burial ground, everything is very foggy and the light feels almost, overcast everything, but it's all in, it still keeps everything in shadow. And when the blue light is coming through the deadfall, that is so perfect because it's all highlighted by the fog and it feels very creepy.
Yeah. Is there anything else about the story or visuals that you want to touch on before we dive into, you know, like box office budget numbers and some final thoughts?
No, I think we touched on most of it.
So what I found interesting about the box office numbers for this is that this is the fifth highest grossing Stephen King movie still, even after the remake came out this year. So its domestic total gross was almost $57.5 million. And it just slightly beats out the remake by like $2.5 million, give or take. So even in 1989, this was a story that people went out and really wanted to go see, despite how absolutely creepy and, you know, not for children it is, though there are children in it. But, you know, just running down the top five here, you have Pet Sematary at 5, Misery at 4, 1408 at 3, which I think surprised me, but I think that more has to do with the time period it was adapted during and who they had in the cast there. So
yeah,
you have that at number 3. You have a big gap between that and The Green Mile at number 2, and then an even bigger gap between The Green Mile and the It remake from 2017.
Yeah, that one just busted through all expectations, and we're all excited for the second one, which I'll be willing to guess that one will be even bigger.
Yeah, with It Chapter 2 and Dr. Sleep coming out this year, I'm definitely expecting some shakeup in this top five here. But
yeah,
to have one of the movies from the 80s still be in the top five as of, you know, the time we're recording this, I think that's pretty amazing. And obviously the 2019 adaptation was a bit of a bummer for a lot of people, and that is one that it'll be a while before I talk about that one, but
we'll get there eventually.
And I just really think that a lot of these movies sort of fell into the like 30 million to 50 million range just because of the time period for most of them. You know, Carrie made 33 million, The Shining made 44, and so on and so forth. Right. And
right. And is that in today's numbers, or is that the numbers they actually earned at the time?
I want to say it's what they earned at the time, because I feel like if you adjusted Carrie for inflation, it would definitely be more than 33 million, given it was the 70s.
Right. And it was huge. Yeah. Just a huge movie. That was what that was one of the things that catapulted him into being considered one of the best horror writers working today, which is Liv Now. And I mean, in the 80s, he was like on everyone's bookshelf. Everybody read Stephen King and everyone was excited for it. And the man is incredibly prolific. So he was putting out, you know, a book a year, if not more.
Yeah.
And this one, I think this movie is kind of iconic. I can't think of anyone I know who hasn't seen it or hasn't, like you said, seen little bits and pieces of it on TV or just watched it on TV. Mm-hmm. Or like, this is such a well-known story for Stephen King and sets kind of a standard for what we can expect from his films for the 80s, you know, which has kind of bled into the 90s for those who have seen a lot of the 90s TV movies. And now I think the It remake set the standard for what we can expect from the good, you know, the Dark Tower definitely set the bar for what the bad can be.
And it still made a lot more money than a bunch of the older movies, which makes me believe that these aren't adjusted for inflation, because the Dark Tower made a little over 50 million. So it puts it at the 8th spot, but really as a success, it's nowhere near the 8th spot.
Right. So I think it's, like you said, it's still really impressive that even though this is like, this was a big movie for him and a big movie at the time, it's still in that top five even now with God knows how many adaptations between this one and It Chapter 2, which is coming out in, six weeks, something like that.
They have 43 movies listed on Box Office Mojo under the Stephen King brand. So that's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if that counts all the Children of the Corn.
No, just two that I see.
Okay, good. Good. We've discussed in the past our thoughts on the Children of the Corn movies.
Yeah. And Cell is on the list, but it doesn't have like any numbers associated with it. So I think it's pretty much anything that got a theatrical release, because like The Lawnmower Man and Lawnmower Man 2 are on this list, even though Stephen King is like, no, those aren't mine. So there are some imperfections with this list. So let's call it 40 movies with actual figures that are actual Stephen King adaptations.
Wow, that's incredible. It's very impressive.
And as you and I know, there's way more than that because of all the Children of the Corn movies and how long my spreadsheet is for this podcast.
Yes. And I do love the fact that it's Mary Lambert and the story of how she got this part as the director, because she could bring the Ramones. because she does a lot of music videos. Even now, she does a lot of music videos. And when King heard that, as you should know if you listen to this podcast and are any kind of King fan, he loves the Ramones almost as much as he loves AC/DC, I would say. And, you know, because she could bring them in, Lambert got the directing job, and she just hits it out of the park with this. And I believe King himself was very happy with how the movie turned out.
And we can't forget that he played a minister. That was his cameo.
That's right. And he's so great at it. Oh, it's so delightful.
Yeah. So needless to say, this movie is pretty grim. And even though it was made in the late 80s, it still gets all of those emotions that you feel when you read the story across, or at least enough of them for you to be like, yes, this is the sort of adaptation I'm looking for when it comes to Pet Sematary. And, you know, we mentioned a few of the things that were in the book that we would have liked to see in an adaptation. And obviously with the remake, we didn't get some of those things still. So it's clear that there are certain aspects of the story that people just don't want to adapt for one reason or another.
Yeah, that for I think sometimes it's because they just seem too complicated to put into the movie. And sometimes it's just preference. And I, too, agree that there's some things that I would really love to see in the movie that would probably push the movie's length to be 2.5 hours, which I don't know this book deserves a 2.5 hour adaptation, even if it includes all the stuff I want.
Yeah, that would be asking people to sit through a lot. And, you know, there are some movies that people are clearly willing to sit through for nearly 3 hours, like Avengers Endgame and whatnot. But
right,
not everything needs to be that long.
No, I'm always happy when I go to a screening and I'm reviewing a movie. I'm like, how long is this? And when I see it's less than 2 hours, I'm like, yes. It's 90 minutes, it's a celebration. Like, oh, awesome, 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Movies that are like never 90 minutes. And if it's good and it's 90 minutes, then like I am just like, this is, you get 5 stars at least. Because I rate on a 10 scale.
Okay.
So it'd be 2.5 stars if you're just a 5-star person.
Yeah. So last thing here then, what did you rate this movie?
I would say this is probably right now in my life, and it might change if I watch this a different time, I would say this is a 3.5 out of 5 for me.
Okay, I have it at 3 out of 5, but that was before watching the documentary and not having rewatched it again before doing this podcast. Like I said, I had rewatched it, or, you know, really watched it for the first time when I went to go see the remake. So I wouldn't say I've seen this enough times to just be like very firm in my rating, but on first impression, I was like, okay, this is a 3 out of 5. You know, they did a lot of things. They left some things out that I would have liked to see, and it stands up pretty well.
Yes, I agree. It's something that this will be a fun movie to show my kid in, I would say, 1.5 years. He's a cat and animal lover, so it's more scary if that's how you are.
Yeah,
I think. Especially since we have 2 cats in our house. Yeah, so I would say 3.5 is definitely that's a good rating for me. I don't give things super high ratings unless I really like them.
Oh, absolutely. Well, Katie, thank you so much for coming on to talk about Pet Sematary today. That wraps this episode. You can follow Chat Sematary on Twitter and on Instagram. It's just Chat Sematary there, so you can just search that and we should pop up. If we don't, well, I don't know what to tell you, but we should. So there is that. And we have a Patreon. You can donate to. The lowest tier is $1 a month. We have a $5 a month tier. If you want to pick a topic for my other podcast, Welcome to Geekdom, I'm still thinking of some other cool rewards that I can offer you guys. And as always, thank you all for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.